From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Domestic violence takes place in our nation every day, occurring for every one in three women who have been assaulted in their lifetime. Most Americans don't realize just how real domestic violence is and how many lives are affected by it. Most cases are left behind closed doors, and today's dialogue is not only to educate and raise awareness, but bring forth the stories, research, community resources, and support for domestic violence survivors. Today, we're sharing the stories of BIPOC women who have not only been affected by domestic violence, but also the women who have been on the front lines of supporting their community in the courtroom, shelters, and hospitals. This episode talks about discrimination, abuse, and trauma that some may find triggering. If you find yourself in crisis, call 800-799-SAFE or text 88788. First, you'll hear from one of our producers on this story, Zainab Qureshi. Hey, Zainab. Thanks for joining me in this dialogue.
Hi, Kennedy. Thanks for having me.
You've been at Illinois Public Media for 4 years now. You've worked in different roles as a producer, and this year you're joining Illinois Soul and Dialogue to talk about some really important topics, one of them being domestic violence. And it's October, it's Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and you brought this story to the forefront, wanting to explore about implicit bias and, of course, how systematic racism is seeping into all of these different institutions involving domestic violence.
Yeah, so a lot of the times what that means is that the people who are trying to help just don't understand the communities, the survivors they're working with. So whether that's a caseworker who doesn't understand how to take care of their client's hair, or maybe it's a legal advocate who is pushing their survivor to talk to the police, even though we know what we know about the relationship between the police and the Black community. It can also show up in hospital rooms where the doctor doesn't prescribe as much medication because they just don't believe that the person is really in that much pain, or they just don't prescribe medication at all because they say that the patient is exhibiting drug-seeking behavior, however they interpret that.
You're producing a really important story on Dialogue. How did this story come about?
So I have this friend who works in domestic violence advocacy space, and she comes home with these harrowing stories. One time she told me about this woman who had been pushed down a flight of stairs by her partner. She was pregnant, and so because of the trauma and the assault, she went into labor prematurely. So she gives birth, she gets out, and she seeks help. And she's on all of these pain meds, and she's trying to take care of this premature baby. She's trying to process what just happened to her, what somebody just did to her. Meanwhile, in the case notes, it reads that she's moody, she's aggressive, she's hostile, which are textbook stereotypes about Black women, which, even if they were true, I would be too if that had just happened to me. So my friend would tell me about these instances where these white clients would be extended so much more grace than the survivors who were Black there.
Zainab, tell us, what were some of the most striking things that you found when you started your initial research?
So many of us know about the statistic where 1 in 3 women worldwide have been assaulted in their lifetime. But what I didn't know was that it's also every 68 seconds that somebody is sexually assaulted in the United States. What I didn't know was that almost half of domestic violence cases at large go unreported. So once I started learning all of this extra context, I just knew somebody had to tell this story.
All my life I've been holding on. It's been crazy, but still I'm stronger. All my life I've been holding on.
Joining the dialogue is Jennifer Drake. She's a survivor, social worker, and owner of a management consulting firm for nonprofits and social change organizations located in St. Louis, Missouri. Jennifer, thank you so much for making space and grace for this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
What kind of services did you receive, and did you feel respected as a Black woman while you were receiving these services?
I think as a general matter, I did feel respected. You know, these are people who are experts in domestic violence, who are experts in what happens to your brain when you're subjected to this sort of treatment and abuse over time. And I think they did their best to sort of recognize that all experiences weren't created equally. I think there were really specific circumstances for me where it wasn't that I necessarily felt disrespected or that I was treated poorly, but there were certainly instances where it was clear that the normal course of treatment or the normal type of advice or recommendations that they might make to a person who is trying to leave a relationship or experiencing ongoing abuse just wouldn't work for me. So for example, there was a lot of reliance on the police as a way to keep us safe. And as a general matter, I sort of understand that. But I also, as a Black woman, have a very complicated relationship to not only police and police departments, but just policing in general.
Oftentimes, survivors are doing it while going through it, meaning they're working that job, they're taking care of their kiddo. On the other side, still enduring abuse. A lot of people in this field have mentioned, you don't even know it's abuse. You don't even know if you can call it abuse, if it ranks under that category. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. You know, my ex-partner never hit me, pushed me, caused me physical harm. I never experienced harm at his expense. But there was a way in which my body and my brain were different because of what I experienced. And I can remember at intake, going in at the urging really of the people around me who were seeing what was happening to me and who were really concerned about some of the mental health challenges that I was having, saying, no, you need to seek these services. And I sat in with the intake specialist who was asking questions that they ask of every person. I can remember it was sort of like being on a turbulent flight where you look at the flight attendants to see like how afraid they look. I was sort of trying to read their expression for like, is this real? And so I remember doing intake and feeling sort of some relief that this person believed me. So I was under the care actually of a hospital psychologist. I told her that I had gone and spoken to the people at this domestic violence service provider. And she looked at me and said, I'm really glad you did that. You are much more likely to get questions like, why did you stay so long than, you know, any type of reverence or congratulations for leaving and you know, pursuing a better life for yourself.
Mm-hmm. That validation when you're in the survivor's seat is critical. And not mm-hmm. only were you living your life, but you're also a social worker. At the time, you were helping other people navigate and process their trauma. What was that experience like for you? Did you experience re-traumatization?
Being able to intellectualize what was happening to me was actually a really helpful skill. And to be clear, like many of my therapists have told me over time, it is not, you know, compartmentalization and intellectualizing your feelings are not good long-term strategies. You know, you do that to get through. But the way that I was able to sort of take myself out of what was happening to me and just sort of look at the facts was a really useful thing and say, if this were a client or if this were an organization was trying to decide whether or not a person needed services, how would I be looking at what was happening to me? And I began to understand that there wasn't very much difference between me and somebody that I might have been helping or an organization that I might have been advising to help someone in this way. It also made me deeply curious about how many of us in many institutions sort of replicate the dynamics of power and control in the work that we do. And it became really easy for me to understand how a person like me with a lot of education and a lot of community support and, you know, I check a lot of boxes in terms of like the things that you're supposed to do right, the people that tell you what you're supposed to do. And yet I found myself in a situation that I may not have ever imagined as a young person would happen to me. But there's a way in which we live in a world where we enable abusers. We romanticize these ideas of power and control. It's very easy for any one of us to wind up in a situation like I was. So I began to get very curious on a societal level about how those things tended to happen to people.
Can you talk a little bit about that, your curiosity on a societal level, right? Maybe you can dive or delve into the systems or how transformative justice needs to take place in order to protect survivors of DV.
You know, as I was moving through my healing, but also interrogating these things, it made me angry, first of all. And I think now that I have some distance, I'm able to meet these dynamics with curiosity and more in a spirit of problem solving. I tend to think of abuse, power, control as sort of a spectrum. Likely there are people who are always experiencing abusive behaviors, but they might not characterize their relationships as abusive. You might have a partner who occasionally raises their voice. You might have a partner who occasionally becomes jealous. But there's a way in which collectively we have such an unhealthy view of what makes relationships work and makes them good, that that sort of spectrum of oppressive behavior is really difficult to sort of say where the line is, for lack of a better word. So, how much jealousy is too much jealousy? How much jealousy can you experience in a relationship where people might look at it and say, oh, you know, he becomes jealous because he really, really cares? And he, you know, or how much financial control is unhealthy, right? Well, maybe he simply wants to be the provider for his family, and he takes that seriously. But where is the line where that sort of financial control becomes pathological or damaging to a person? You know, we don't have really helpful ways for talking about how we exist along that spectrum and how we often romanticize the very behaviors that can become problematic to people who are, especially are experiencing emotional abuse. You know, how are we talking about egalitarian partnerships as a way to enable how women can participate fully in civic life? I often talk to women who are very scared to leave their relationships because they, you know, they can only imagine this binary future where, you know, they have their life with their partner or their life without their partner. And what I often say to them, which was really true to me, is that no, your choices are not life with this person or life without this person. Your choices are life with this person and this unfathomable future that likely has so much opportunity waiting for you. Simply because your capacity is not so diminished by this person who is very actively like trying to squash you.
Thank you so much for sharing all of that. When I hear you talk about not just your experience, but so many other women who have gone through this as well, you had mentioned the luxury of falling apart. What does the luxury of falling apart look like? What does it feel like? How beneficial is it to feminine energy?
I was working full time. I was caregiving to a sick partner. I had a toddler. I was trying to figure out, I was actually finishing grad school at the time too. I graduated shortly before I left. And there's a way in which you have to keep all these balls in the air so as not to compromise this facade that you've built about what your life actually is. And dropping those balls makes you feel very vulnerable. Like, what if somebody knows what's happening to me? What if somebody knows that things aren't perfect? What if my child starts to perceive the dynamics of my relationship? And so I felt like I did not have the luxury of being vulnerable about any of that. And I think that probably is why it took me so long to seek services and why it took me so long to leave the relationship. One of the ways that I reflect on that time in my life is like getting a call from my best friend who had just gotten off the phone with my mother. And she called me and she said, "We are not doing this anymore. We have a plan for you. Like, even if you don't have the plan, we have the plan for you." And so even when I did finally, when it felt like I was falling apart, I was very much falling into the arms of people who loved me and they were there to catch me. And I'm not sure that I would have left when I did if they hadn't extended that to me. Like, it is safe for you to admit that this is not working and that it is harming you. And we're here to help you pick up those pieces. Because it just felt like, what if I lose my job? What if I lose this family? What if I lose my home? What if I lose my child? I think that's something that's very common for women, especially who are in abusive relationships, is that they really fear what a partner might do in order to keep the children away from them. The luxury of falling apart was not something that I had. And when I was able to finally sort of drop the balls that I had been holding, it was only because of my support system.
Jennifer Drake, thank you so much for sharing your story and your experience today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for the opportunity to chat.
That was Jennifer Drake. She's a survivor of nearly 7 years ago, and now she helps other nonprofits and social change organizations through her own management firm. Coming up, we'll hear from experts on how implicit bias hurts Black women seeking help for domestic violence. If you're in crisis, call 800-799-SAFE. Stay with us on Dialogue after this short break. From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Domestic violence takes place in our nation every day, occurring for every one in three women who have been assaulted in their lifetime. If you find yourself in crisis, call 800-799-SAFE or text 88788. We welcome Dr. Kira Banks to Dialogue, a psychologist and associate professor at St. Louis University. She speaks to us about trauma-informed care and care spaces and the emotional and psychological impacts of discrimination. Dr. Kira Banks, thank you so much for having this conversation with us.
Thanks for having it. I think it's important to lift up.
Can you talk to us about the difference between discrimination and implicit bias?
So implicit bias is an attitude that we have that we might not be fully conscious of. It happens in the you know, snap, quick judgment moments, and it might be subtle, and it's often shaped by the stories that we're told about people, our own people groups. We can have bias, implicit bias for our groups, and we can have implicit bias against groups that we're not in. And so those are attitudes. Discrimination is an act. It's a behavior. And so when we act on our biases, that's discrimination.
Can you share some examples of how shelters can unintentionally perpetuate bias?
Yeah, so if we think about some of the biases, the assumptions that people make about, let's say, Black women in particular, there's the trope of the angry Black woman, right? And so you might say, oh, I don't have a prejudice bone in my body, but we all have seen the stories, the narratives, and have been around. Beverly Tatum talks about racism being like smog in the air and you can't help but breathe it in. And so like, if we have this bias that Black women are angry and aggressive and we should be scared of them when they are in a very vulnerable position when they're in a domestic violence shelter, and they might be acting from a place of anger, of fear, of despair. The way that they might emote or express themselves, if someone has a story already of them being angry Black women, they might get read as dangerous in a way that if it were a white woman engaging in the same sort of rage and expression of fear or despair or anger, might just be given the grace of context, what she's been through. Let's hold space for her. Let's think about what she is up against and understand what she's experiencing rather than label her as dangerous, which then ends up perpetuating this cycle. So you come to a place and you're vulnerable, having experienced domestic violence, you get labeled as dangerous. You might not even get the services you came for. And that just breeds mistrust.
Can you explain how systemic racism manifest in places like domestic violence shelters?
Yeah, so systemic racism, that happens at the institutional level, right? And so that would be the data that we would try to understand. Are Black women disproportionately not getting served at the same rate? Are we seeing more Black women either turned away from services or ejected from domestic violence shelters? So that is what I'd want us to question if we're thinking about the experience of domestic violence and how systemic racism shows up. We have to look at the rate at which things are happening.
We spoke with a CEO, Elizabeth Cook, of Courage Connections here. It's a local shelter in Urbana-Champaign. And she said that they used trauma-informed care to mitigate this implicit bias. What role do you think trauma-informed care plays in addressing racial trauma and domestic violence trauma? Is that good enough?
So I think trauma-informed care is an important framework in the sense that it pushes practitioners and clinicians and actually staff members too, to take into consideration the trauma that individuals have experienced as they're implementing their care models. And so in theory, it's great. We should be engaging in trauma-informed care. In practice, it depends. And so my question, when whether it's schools or shelters or any system claims to use trauma-informed care, my question is a follow-up one to ask, tell me more. What does that look like? How are you engaging in it? And if there is not only training, but also sustained work, then there's more of a chance that it's doing what it can do, right? So to just say we do trauma-informed care on its face isn't enough. But if there's mechanisms to make sure that clinicians not only are being trained, but perhaps it's even incorporated in their supervision, or perhaps there's peer consultation groups, or perhaps there's an ongoing kind of reflective iterative process where the shelter says, hey, let's look at our numbers and make sure that there are no disparities on the basis of race. Hey, let's sample some of the women who've come through the shelter to ask them about their experiences. And maybe even giving mechanisms for women who are in the shelter to share their experiences, to say loudly, we want to be trauma-informed and we want to make sure that we have racial equity and that everyone has access to the services they need. If you feel like you're not being treated fairly, here's who you reach out to. And so with all of those different pieces in place, there's more of a likelihood that our trauma-informed care actually happens and gets implemented.
Mm-hmm. How does experiencing implicit bias in a space that's supposed to be safe impact the mental health and just the healing process of Black women and women of color?
It definitely interrupts the healing process because it feels like an institutional betrayal, right? Like domestic violence is not something that is always easy for people to come forward around. And there's a added layer for Black women specifically, and then women of color broadly, that there are all sorts of negative narratives about our men of color, about Black men specifically, that can make you feel like, oh, I don't want to add to that narrative. So do I say something? Do I get help? Do I seek help? Do I rationalize behavior? Do I figure out how I take on the burden to fix things myself? And so when you come to a place where you're saying, I need help, and then are treated in a way that is racist, basically, it hurts on a level that it's like you're already feeling like you're in pain and you're harmed, and you're trying to take steps to help yourself, and you get knocked down again. So it interrupts the healing. It adds another layer of harm that really victims could do without.
From your perspective, what changes need to happen with domestic violence shelters to just ensure that survivors from all backgrounds are receiving equitable care?
We need to keep the conversations happening. When I work with organizations and I ask them, do you know by zip code, race, socioeconomic status, any sort of difference that matters in your area, that everyone is getting access to your services and that everyone is having the same level of satisfaction and outcomes? And if you can't answer the question, you don't know. And so what needs to happen is we need to continue to ask the question, continue to analyze our data and our outcomes, because if we don't ask the question, we can't get better. And so I know it's scary to ask the question because you don't really want to know if you're not doing well. But I actually think most of these services, most of these agencies at the core want to serve. And so if you want to serve, part of doing that is asking the question in an ongoing way and being open to feedback from the folks that you serve.
Dr. Kira Banks, thank you so much for joining me in this conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, we're joined with Amy Williams. She's a previous client advocate at multiple shelters across Illinois and Missouri. She shares her experiences as she worked with survivors in the hospital, courtrooms, and shelters. Dialogue's producer Zainab Qureshi joins me in this conversation with Amy Williams. Amy, thank you so much for joining us in this conversation.
So emergency rooms and courtrooms are pretty traumatic environments for survivors. But Black survivors have to deal with not just their trauma, they have to confront the fact that they may be treated differently there because of their race. So looking back, do you remember there being a heightened sense of stress in those moments?
In the courtroom, especially, usually survivors were very aware of the way they were being perceived. They knew that they were getting different treatment because of their race. And so there's also a balance of validating that. You have to acknowledge that it is happening and that it is wrong.
When you were witnessing some of these things happen to clients or just other clients within the facility, was there any instance where you would speak up or speak out against this or just had a conversation with admin like, hey, this is what I'm noticing and it's not okay?
When I was in the volunteer capacity, I did not feel empowered to go to admin. And I don't know if that was me just feeling like I don't know these people, it's awkward to go to them. I don't want to say that's on the organization. So there were a lot of times when I would see things and I would not bring it back to the organization I was working for, which in hindsight was a mistake because they can't go do the advocacy they need to do if they don't know this is happening.
So when these things happen, how do they react?
So you get a really wide range of reactions. And one of the things that an advocate tries to do is to be a safe space for all of those emotions. So one of the things I really tried to do with the people I worked with was make sure they did have that space to be frustrated, to be angry, to say the things that they can't say in the courtroom because they are trying to maintain a particular image. It's there. You can see it taking the toll on their mental health. They're already trying to navigate so many really complex, traumatic things and having that additional layer of trauma on top of it.
That must have been very hard to witness. Was there ever a moment in your advocacy work where you really felt the weight of what was happening in front of you and what was taking place in these people's lives?
There are some cases that really stick with me. The things that people experienced were so awful that they're sort of things that you never really walk away from or forget, even though I've been out of the field for 4 or 5 years at this point. The more I got into this work, the deeper I was into it, the less trust I had in those systems to be able to be what helps survivors.
I know you've mentioned that you witnessed just implicit bias in the different places you were working at. Is there any specific examples you could share?
Yeah. I've seen some injuries that are pretty terrifying. Things that, you know, they do stick with you. The story about the person who was being accused of drug seeking, and that was a person that had really awful injuries. Like, you know, I just walked in the room. I didn't actually hear a story by the time that was happening, but I could look at this person and go, no way. Something happened to them. I haven't even asked any questions yet, and I believe that something has happened to them. There was a case that did involve a Black woman who was trying to keep her family safe, but she was repeatedly dismissed by the court system and then even by her own attorney. Her own attorney came up to me at one point and said, you know, this person is really angry. I don't know if they believe what they're telling me. You should be careful if you're going to be an advocate for this case. This is a person that was supposed to support her.
What would you like to see change in not only the field of DV, but DV advocacy, but also the court system? Like, I know it's such a long-winded question, but just in terms of addressing not only implicit bias, but just these larger issues of racial equity.
I want us to shift the way we think about survivors and who's a good victim and who's a bad victim. This idea that you only deserve support, you only deserve your order of protection if you are doing the good victim things.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate you.
Thank you for having me here.
October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Today on Dialogue, we're speaking with survivors and experts who research trauma-informed care. Stay with us on Dialogue after this short break. From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Domestic violence takes place in our nation every day, occurring for every 1 in 3 women who have been assaulted in their lifetime. Today, we're sharing the stories of BIPOC women who have not only been affected by domestic violence, but also the women who have been on the front lines of supporting their community in the courtroom, shelters, and hospitals. This episode talks about discrimination, abuse, and trauma that some may find triggering. If you find yourself in crisis, call 800-799-SAFE or text 88788. Joining the conversation now is Dean Linda Ammons. She's worked extensively on the intersection of racial justice, gender, and domestic violence. Her work spans back to the 90s. She worked as the executive assistant for legislative affairs to Ohio Governor Richard Celeste. Ammons contributed to policies about domestic violence and was notably a part of the pioneering granting of clemency for battered women convicted of killing their abusers. She joins us to talk more about racial tropes Black women face, cultural competency in shelter care, and how mistrust of police plays a role in whether survivors are able to access help.
Dean Ammons, thank you so much for joining us in this conversation today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Can you tell us about your time working for Governor Richard Frank Celeste? He granted clemency for women who had been convicted of killing their abusers. Tell us about your role in that process and how it shaped your views on domestic violence and the criminal justice system.
Well, when I worked for Governor Celeste, I was his executive assistant for regulatory and administrative matters. And under that rubric, the criminal justice system was my responsibility. I was responsible for the adult and juvenile correction facilities on one side, and then a whole host of other agencies ranging from insurance to the National Guard. And one day I got an email from Governor Celeste stating, and this was toward the end of his tenure, his second term, stating he wanted to look at cases dealing with domestic violence where women claimed self-defense or could have claimed self-defense, but were currently in Ohio prisons. At that time, there were 10 Ohio prisons and two of them were for women. I was a bit shocked at the assignment, considering the lateness of his tenure, trying to understand what it would take to do a systematic approach to this as opposed to just a random kind of approach. It took about a year and a half, a year of doing research, working with the prison system, educating myself first and foremost, educating the governor, educating the parole board, and then putting together a mechanism by which these women's cases could be reviewed. There was mechanism somewhat already in place in terms of the pardons and parole board at that particular time, but they had to be educated about this issue of domestic violence because at that time, and we're talking about the late 1980s, there had never been anything on this scale done before. There had been one other governor, I believe he was in Illinois. He may have granted clemency to maybe four women. But when we finished, there were somewhere between 26, 28, I can't remember the exact number at this time, women who were granted clemency because their cases showed that they had acted in self-defense or had been the courts or have been overly punitive, or I should say the courts, but the prosecutors have been overly punitive in pursuing these cases. And so that's how I became involved in this. It was a long, arduous, gut-wrenching process, the kind of brutality that I witnessed in terms of looking at the files. Also, I had an opportunity to see some of these women. It was just a tremendous project that had to be undertaken. And people knew, when you talk to them, people knew that something was wrong and we had to do something about it.
In regards to the work you were doing in Ohio, was there a through line with any of the research, any of the cases you were working on with battered women in regards to systematic racism or any repeating themes that you were seeing within the cases?
Oh, well, it's been going, the systematic racism has been going on for a long time and it continues. I mean, we don't have time for me to go back to the founding of the country and how Black women actually got here, why they were brought here. They weren't brought here as regular immigrants. They were brought here for work. They were brought here as chattel. They were viewed as perhaps a step above animals. I don't know how many remember the O.J. Simpson case, but there was another case where a Black woman was on trial for defending herself and the defense wanted to get in evidence the fact that this woman had been severely battered and she did not have the wherewithal to get out and stay out of that kind of situation. So in this particular case at trial, the prosecutor looked at the jury and stated that this Black woman was no Nicole Simpson. And what he was basically saying was, where Nicole Simpson was the fair-haired white woman who allegedly was abused and killed by O.J. Simpson, although he was acquitted of those charges, this Black woman could not be compared by any means to Nicole Simpson. And that particular statement was rich in the stereotypes and racial tropes that Black women have suffered under for a very long time. And I found this consistent with looking at some of these cases on review. And there was an African-American woman whose husband was either on the police force or very closely connected with the police force. Everybody knew that this woman was being brutalized. No question about it. In fact, in many of the cases that I reviewed, there was evidence. People said this woman was being abused. The death of the abuser often happened in the heat of battle, but people wouldn't do anything about it. So in the case of this Black woman who was married to an African-American man who was abusing her, she fought back and he was killed. And no one came to her rescue to try to say that this was in the heat of an incident. She should not have pled to a sentence. And I believe her sentence was something like 26 years to life. Nobody gets that kind of sentence in terms of self-defense.
This sounds like a lot of the strong Black woman stereotype. And I know that you've written about this in your own work. How does this stereotype and this pattern of dehumanization impact the care received by Black survivors in shelters?
There is this notion that African-American women are so strong that they may not need the kind of care that other women need. Racial stereotypes have been embedded in many of our systems, and people are people. Sometimes I can tell you what African-American women have complained about is that they are seen to not need as much as others or condescending. So on the one hand, they may be perceived as, oh, well, you're so strong, you don't need what we are providing for others. And it may not be racial animus that is the driving factor. It could just be that workers are not trained to treat each individual as an individual on the one hand, but on the other hand, because this issue is so complex, understand that the life paths of many African-American women are going to be different. We're not the same in that respect, but in terms of human beings who need to be safe, who need not to fear for their lives, who need to take care of their children, who need assistance, we are the same.
In your work, you wrote a study of the shelter movement in America, and it led a researcher to conclude that Black women are ignored in the policymaking, the planning, the implementation of shelter services. You've also drawn a through line to cultural competency and how this is impacted when you leave Black women out of making a decision. What is the correlation? Can you talk more about that? When you leave Black women out of the equation, how do the shelter spaces lack so much cultural competency?
When you are providing services for people, you need to know as much as you possibly can about the people for whom you are providing services. And in terms of cultural competence, I'll give you an example. Early on, 20 years ago, there were issues about why African-American women were not accessing domestic violence shelters. And one of the issues, just one of them, which is the same today, is that they were afraid not only that their abuser might find them and kill them, but they were also afraid of how police might deal with their abuser. And we have evidence today to show that often the police are not fair in dealing with suspects, particularly if they are men of color. And so these women were and are afraid, well, if I call the police, this thing could escalate beyond where I really wanted to go. And sooner or later, he's going to get out. And sooner or later, he's going to find me. And he's going to be mad that he's in the criminal justice system. Or it could be that the police might kill him. And that's what they believe. And so I'm not going to do that. This is the father of my children. I love this man. The community would be upset. All of these things factor in to why any particular woman of color, and particularly African-American woman, might decide not to access the shelters, not to call the police. And so they don't leave. They don't go to the shelters. In the shelters themselves, you have people. They are people. They may have their own biases, not only in terms of the workers themselves, but the people who are their cohabitants who are in these shelters may not want to be in shelters with people of color.
Dean Ammons, you've also mentioned that the less shelters in America, the larger lack of care for clients. What has your research found within that?
I have not seen any data that suggests that domestic violence has disappeared or anywhere close to that. 30 years ago, the statistic was every 15 seconds, a woman in America is battered. I don't know whether that's been updated or not. But I can say that with certainty that there is not enough help, culturally sensitive, culturally competent help.
Dean Ammons, thank you so much for joining us in this conversation. We're very grateful for you to share your expertise and knowledge during this year's Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I'm grateful to have the opportunity to talk about something that is really, really important. Human beings want to be loved and cherished, and we have a responsibility to try to make sure that that happens.
The Dialogue team would like to thank Jennifer Drake, Dr. Kira Banks, Amy Williams, and Dean Linda Ammons for making this episode possible. If you or anyone you know is suffering, you don't have to suffer alone. Call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233 or text BEGIN to 88788. Find the Dialogue podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. And you can give us a follow on Instagram and Facebook at Illinois Soul. This episode of Dialogue was produced by Zainab Qureshi, Troy McDonald, and myself, Kennedy Vincent. Our news and public affairs director is Reginald Hardwick, and production assistance by Steve Mork. Dialogue is a part of Illinois Soul and Illinois Public Media. Join us for our next dialogue every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. and Tuesday night at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul FM 101.1 and WILL AM 580 Wednesdays at 8 p.m.